Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Congressman John Katko. Congressman Katko is serving in his third term and represents New York's 24th congressional district. The district includes all of Cayuga, Onondaga, and Wayne counties and the western portion of Oswego County. Congressman Katko serves on the Homeland Security Committee and the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. Congressman Katko, thanks once again for making the time for this conversation. I know that you and your colleagues have a very full plate at the moment.
We do indeed, but I'm glad to be part of this. I always enjoy having the conversations with you. And I always notice that the time flies when we're doing these.
Yes, it does. It absolutely does. And speaking of that, in some ways, the last time that you and I spoke was not very long ago. It was the latter part of May, and listeners to this program can find that program on WRVO's website. I don't know about you, but it feels to me like it was not 3 months ago, it was a year ago. How have you been in the last 3 months?
Boy, I tell you what, it really does seem like it's a year ago since we last spoke, because a lot has happened since May, as you know. And, look back, in February, everybody was talking about was impeachment. In April and May, all anyone was talking about was COVID. And then in June, of course, we had the civil unrest, and now here we are in early August, and Lord knows what the big issue is going to be tomorrow, but it certainly is an interesting time that we're in.
Yeah, interesting indeed. Let's talk about COVID for a little bit, and why don't you tell me? Can you tell me what you have been focusing on, and your office has been focusing on, regarding the response to COVID since we last talked, since late May, and maybe think about both locally here in the Syracuse area, but also as a nation as a whole. What have you been focusing on?
Yeah, well, first of all, we are focusing on trying to deal with managing my office in D.C. and Syracuse in totally different conditions. When I go to D.C., I have no staff there because they're all working remotely for safety reasons. And then it's similar in Syracuse here. So that's been a huge adjustment to engage with my staff. But from a substantive standpoint, we've been doing everything we can to help move the ball forward on COVID relief. There's all kinds of things I've been doing. For example, I've been continuously advocating for additional funding, PPE testing, kits, and all of the medical supplies for Central New York hospitals. I've been engaged with the hospitals on a first-name basis with all the administrators of all the hospitals in Central New York because of it. And I'm leading efforts to urge direct funding to local governments. That's been a real struggle, to say the least, and we can talk more about that in a moment if you want. I've been consistently pounding IRS to get better service Central New York. Some of the mistakes they've made have been pretty bad. Advocating for additional funding and support for local small businesses, and spearheading efforts to ensure confidence in our election system. So we've been very, very busy, and also obviously trying like heck to get the cooler heads prevail with respect to leadership on both sides, the aisle and the White House, because we've got to get the next package done. America's depending on it, and we got to get it done.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up with several of those things that you mentioned. But you mentioned the leadership on that, so let me take that one first. And you and I talked about this in May, but again, a lot has happened, I think, with the White House since then. And I think it's fair to say that verbally, President Trump has always been a loose cannon. I seem to remember you saying something once about the reason that God invented scotch.
But that's very true.
But I wanted to ask you, seriously on this, do you think that verbal lack of discipline has hurt the national leadership on COVID?
Oh, there's no question that Trump's verbal lack of discipline has muddied the waters, to say the least. And it takes away from a lot of the things that we've been able to accomplish. But be that as it may, I think that his lack of discipline has hurt. But you know what? Quite frankly, and some of the discipline on all sides has hurt us. I mean, Nancy Pelosi and some of the things she's done and some of the things she's said is designed to be incendiary. And when I look at the lack of leadership and during this COVID crisis, I don't think there's any clean hands. I don't think Mitch McConnell has clean hands. I don't think Chuck Schumer has clean hands. I don't think Nancy Pelosi has clean hands. And I certainly don't think the president does, because they're all trying to score political points more than they are trying to get things done. And that wasn't how it started out. If you really look back on the CARES Act when it started, It was unbelievable amount of bipartisan legislation came together and came together quickly and seemed to really work and unite the country. And then things started slipping as we got closer to election time. And that's an environment we're in now, and it's very unfortunate.
Yeah, it is obvious that this has become incredibly politicized. But I wanted to focus a little more specifically the question that I asked and think about the president and his rhetoric regarding the public health impacts of it, in particular mask wearing and social distancing and just the general attitude toward opening up the economy and spillover that it seems to have had on the behavior of a lot of individuals across the country. And that is, I think, something that has concerned a lot of observers. The specific question I wanted to ask you about that was, has his leadership on the public health aspect of this issue made you reconsider or rethink your endorsement of his reelection?
Well, I certainly put that into the total mix about the endorsement issue. And mind you, don't forget, this endorsement is not of this president saying he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. This and because I, Lord knows, my record is replete, and we could spend the next hour talking about how I've broken with him many times, starting with his seminal move, and that's repealing the Affordable Care Act. And I was one of the few to stand up to him on that one. So it's not a question whether I've stood up to him. I have. It's a question of where we're going in this country as a whole, philosophically and politically. And the Democratic Party has been lurched so far left that I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned about Biden as well from the standpoint of, is he going to be able to stop the barbarians at the gate, if you will, the far left from completely overtaking the agenda if he becomes president? I don't think he would be able to, and that's my concern. So I'm not, there's no ringing endorsement of this president or his attitude or his demeanor or his personality. This is much more about where we are philosophically as a nation and where we're going. Are we going to go to Medicare for all? Are we going to go to all these be apologists for illegal aliens or committing crimes and not deport them? All those things are going to be at the forefront of the next administration if Biden wins. And he I'm not sure he's going to be able to resist it, because he's going to have an awful lot of pressure to take on these agendas. And that is what's very troubling to me. And so, I no matter who's president, though, I am speaking up. There's no question about it. I will be a cheerleader for Biden if he's in. I want him to be the most successful president, just like I did Biden and just like I did Trump. And I'll say it when I'll support him any way I can. And when I can't, I'll do it in a professional and dignified manner. And I'll do the same for President Trump. And I've got a track record of doing that. So the person in the White House is somewhat less important than it is the philosophies which their parties represent. And that's what we're really talking about. And that's what I'm very concerned about.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Rehert, and I'm speaking with Congressman John Katko. Well, let's get into some of the things that you mentioned a bit earlier and looking at the possibility of the next relief package. You mentioned a couple of things I think were related to that. One is the direct funding going to state and local governments. I think you mentioned that you thought that was important. Talk about that just briefly.
Oh, it's critically important. What happened in the CARES Act, and it's one of those things, okay, do you vote no because there is this anomaly in it, or do you vote yes just to get the money to people? So we knew we had to fix this going forward. But here's what happened. In the CARES Act, we appropriated direct funding to cities and counties of 500,000 or more, right? And for example, Monroe County, and which includes the city of Rochester, got just about $129 million in funding. Onondaga County was just below that, so they didn't get any direct funding. We gave $7.8 billion to New York State, and some of that money was meant to be sent to the smaller municipalities. We, in the CARES Act, we did not specify the amounts or the formula, so it gave the governor discretion. And guess what? The governor didn't give him any money. So here we are these months later, and Onondaga County has a huge revenue shortfall because of the sales tax revenue that didn't happen because, for example, Destiny USA generates $50 million a year in sales tax revenue for Onondaga County, and they were closed for several months. So there's a big revenue shortfall in the county and a big one in the city. And so I've been working since then and advocating since then to try and get the money to direct funding to the city and the county, counties of less than 500,000. That to me has been extraordinarily important. And I've led letters on that. I've led all kinds of bipartisan measures, both legislatively and otherwise, to try and get that that direct funding, because it's critically important.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think the chances are that Americans will see another federal enhancement of unemployment benefits and another round of stimulus checks? How would you handicap the chances of both of those things?
Well, I'm hopeful of it still. It's becoming more murky as each day goes by, and it seems to be less of a priority on either side. And politics has absolutely consumed this process now, which is unfortunate, because I think all Americans were proud of how we all gathered together and got the CARES Act done. And that to me was the prime example of what can be done when people put down their swords and work together. And they got it. What I would argue is a great package. The unemployment benefits have got to continue in some way, shape, or form. The only question is whether it's going to have that premium of the $600 on it. For those people that are concerned about that, very simple solution. This is one example of what I would do if I was in the room negotiating. If you don't want to maybe tie that money to the unemployment benefits, fine. For people of a certain income range or less who are on unemployment, or all Americans, whatever, you can still give them direct payments that just don't tie to unemployment if you're worried about that. And just give them direct payments to help them out through this time and help stimulate the economy. Because even though it was a real problem for employers trying to get people to come back to work, that extra $600 per person clearly helped keep this economy afloat through a very rough patch. And it's clearly paid dividends, because our recovery is going to be quicker than people think. If we do one more punch of that, I think it would really make a huge difference. And that's what I'm advocating for.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's some talk I've read about making the stimulus checks either bigger this time than they were before, or even further out, making them more frequent. Do you think either of that is likely?
It is a possibility. I know the president supports it. I know some of us in the Republican Party do. There's also a lot of the fiscal conservatives who think we shouldn't be doing anything. Well, I'm not sure there's many economists worth their salt who will tell you that we should not do anything else. Most economists say, look, it's terrible that we're expanding the deficit, but at the same time, it'd be much worse if we don't act, just like they felt the same way in March. And if we can get through this next patch, I think one more tranche might be enough to get us over the economic hump. I'm hopeful of that. And I think that most people believe that.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Congressman John Katko. He represents New York's 24th Congressional District. So before the break, you were mentioning some economists expressing concern about the price tag of all this and whether, you know, we ought to do more to stimulate the economy. And I did want to ask you about that, because that price tag so far of relief is huge in historical terms. And it seems like it's going to get bigger. As you say, there's a good chance that the Congress and the president may be able to agree on something additional and significant. Back in May, when you voted against the HEROES Act, which you've already spoken about, the Democrat initiative in the House of Representatives, you said, though, that you weren't intimidated by the size and the scope of the bill because the response to the national emergency needed to match the size and scope of the crisis. And I think you reiterated those sentiments in the first part of our conversation. I guess my question about this is, you know, thinking about the debt and the deficit, when will we know that we've spent all that it is prudent to spend of our future taxpayers' money trying to mitigate the economic fallout from this? I mean, how do we know when we've reached the point where we've got to say, okay, that is as far as we can go?
Well, I, if anybody can tell you what they know that perfect spot is, they're lying to you. We don't know when is a perfect time to do it. But we do know, based on economic indicators, a double-digit unemployment, that's probably the highest unemployment since the Great Depression, that it's not It's not over yet. And we also know that if we don't do it, the economic models show that the loss of tax revenue going forward would be catastrophic. So you got to try and find that balance. And I guess the best way to say it is, if we can get through the next few months and hope to God that the virus finally plays out, we may not need to do any more. But if we have to, because the virus is raging on, we have to do it. Just like in the Great Depression, I think they were doing things to hopefully make sure that they work. I would argue that the CARES Act helped keep the economy afloat through a very difficult time, and the markets reflect that because they're betting on the future of our economy is going to be really good in another 6 months to a year because the market's going up like crazy, and it's almost back to where it was. So if we have to be prudent, and just let's say we're going to spend $3.2 trillion on the HEROES Act, and I can get into all the details of the HEROES Act from an economic standpoint, which made no sense. Some of it was good, but some of it's just crazy. But then there's also some political ramifications of it. But all that aside, right now it's clear, the economists make it clear, that more stimulation in the economy could have a very positive effect and may get us over the hump.
That's interesting to compare the future lost tax revenues and thinking about the price tag of this. That's an interesting way to think about it. Let me move off COVID and get into another area that you mentioned at the beginning of one of the things that you've been focusing your attention on. And that is your work regarding cybersecurity and infrastructure protection. And in particular, you've been vocal about protecting the integrity and confidence in our electoral system, but also, I believe, cybersecurity for those who are now working from home. So what's going on with those two big issues? And what do you think government needs to be doing that it's not currently doing now?
Well, we are sort of out in front on this, more so than before. And to take a step back, I've said before, and I think I've said it on your show before, our cybersecurity issues in this country remind me an awful lot of the signals we were receiving pre 9/11 about terrorist activity coming our way that were ignored because of stovepipes. That's why I got on a cybersecurity committee. I don't want to run from the problem. I want to run to it and try and help. And so what we've been doing in the cybersecurity realm is really from a general standpoint, we are trying to plug all the holes as best we can. We appropriate a lot of funding for beefing up cybersecurity at Homeland Security and the Department of Defense. Department of Defense is more offensive capabilities. Cyber is more of a Homeland Security is more of a defensive capabilities. So we've been doing a lot with that. Then came along in recent months the results of a Cyber Solarium Commission, which is kind of like a 9/11 style commission for cyber. What can we do better? And the good thing about it is they did it before the catastrophic cyber attack happened. And because of that, there's a lot of recommendations that myself and others put into the National Defense Authorization Act that is going to make cybersecurity as a whole much better. And there's much more we need to do, including try and get recommendations such as having a national cybersecurity director at the executive level to be kind of like the ONDCP, the drug czar, if you will, for cyber, and help coordinate all different agencies and make sure they're all talking to each other. We need that. But so that's what's going on a national scale. But as far as election security goes, we've appropriated a lot more money to the Election Advisory Committee, which is or the EAC, I believe that's the acronym, to make sure that they're doing what they can to help with get the local election commissions ready. I did a roundtable with the election security folks in Central New York and New York State to try and identify the cybersecurity issues, and we've identified a lot of them, and I've had legislation that we can talk about regarding that. And then we're also just trying to make sure we get funding so that they can handle the changes to election security that are coming. The president is wrongly blending two different issues. One is mail-in voting systems, which is going on in California, which has got a lot of examples of fraud and mismanagement. And he's blending that with absentee ballots in New York State. Absentee ballot system in New York State is very different, and it's not meant for everybody, but during a pandemic, using the absentee ballot system would be a good thing. And we have to make sure we make the people, they have the resources to count the ballots, make sure there's not fraud and everything else. But so far, the absentee ballot system in New York State, I think, can work as long as we make sure we get enough money and resources to the front lines to help them administer it.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is New York Congressman John Katko. Just on that last point, actually, I want to ask you a set of different questions, but make a quick observation here. I guess the nightmare scenario, though, for the country would be is if we have another razor close election and there are tons of absentee ballots around the country, we'll be waiting for results. And then the politicization of that is almost unimaginable. But
Yes, it is. That's a big concern. I mean, look what happened in the primary in New York State.
Yeah.
It took them several weeks to certify the primary results. That's going to happen. But hopefully, like New York State, obviously is not going to be an issue. But if you have other states, I think from the presidential standpoint, it's going to be an issue. But like for my race, hey, if it's a close race, we may not know for weeks. Mm. And every day that goes by is going to raise the skepticism of the validity of the results. So we've got to do all we can to try and make sure that we get this done as quickly as possible and go from there.
So I want to leave the rest of the time to talk about just politics and
yippee.
Let me ask you a question about Joe Biden first. You mentioned Joe Biden earlier and concerns about his ability to kind of rein in what might be produced if the entire Congress, the Senate, went to Democrat. But I want to ask you a different question. It's about his campaign right at the moment. He is starting to get, I think, even some bipartisan criticism for avoiding the press. One commentator called his campaign a rose basement strategy. Do you see that criticism as warranted?
I do. I really like Joe Biden as a person. And I've had discussions with him when he was vice president. He spent time chatting with my son. There's no personal animosity whatsoever against him. But I am concerned that they are sheltering him so much. And it does feed into some of the things. When you see some of the things he's said, you have to be concerned whether he is up for the task. And he's going to be the oldest president ever. And there is some cognitive concerns that may or may not be warranted. But we really don't know because it's been such a structured and controlled campaign. No one really has a good feel whether or not he's going to be able to handle the strictures of being president. And I think that's something that the media should be concerned with. And yes, there's a honeymoon, and yes, there's a thirst to replace Trump. I understand that by many in the public eye. I got that. But I don't think we should turn a blind eye to what has been a very, very sheltered campaign so far. And that's something I think that people should be concerned about.
And very briefly, what do you think about his VP pick, Kamala Harris?
It's not surprising. I don't think it moves the needle that much one way or another. She is, and it makes my earlier point, she is very, very liberal on a lot of issues like Medicare for All and all the other things that she's had. Her record is very, very clear that she's a very, very strong California liberal. And that is what I'm talking about with this election. It's not so much about Biden. It's not so much about Trump. It's about political philosophies. And it's reflective in their choices for their running mates as well. And that's one of the things that I'm very concerned about.
So we've got a couple minutes left. I want to ask you a couple of questions about the politics of your race. I always focus a lot of attention on campaign messaging. And there are a couple messages out there now I wanted to ask you about. This one kind of circles back to something that you talked about earlier when you were talking about your endorsement of President Trump's reelection in terms of what's the nature of that support. And this is something that your Democratic opponent, Dana Balter, has been talking a lot about in her messaging. She's called your endorsement of President Trump full-throated, and obviously that campaign strategy is going to be to try to align you as much as possible with the president. You mentioned this before, but I just want to put the question directly to you. Is your endorsement full-throated? What is the nature of your support here? Are we talking about, I don't know if this is the term you want to use, lesser of two evils, but explain that a little bit. And I have one more question I want to fit in. So
sure. I think that throughout this interview, I've articulated that stance. And for her to say that I'm a full-throated endorsement of Trump, it's just completely dishonest. I mean, I couldn't be the second most bipartisan member in all of Congress. And one of the by both sides, I viewed as a person they can always deal with and work with if that were true. It's just not true. And the record is replete of me standing up to Trump all the time. I mean, if you look at the healthcare vote, opposing the government shutdown. I opposed the government shutdown 8 times in a row and then went and looked at President in the eye and told him why I thought like that. And he was really pissed at me. But that's okay. I oppose a GOP lawsuit standing up to people with pre-existing conditions and all the other things they're trying to tie me to. And it really kind of boils down to, like I said earlier, where are we going as a country politically? Are we going to go to a far left philosophy and we're going to Medicare for all and we're going to, which even Biden himself has said would bankrupt this country? You know, is that where we're going to go? Or do we have to do what I'm doing now? So I'll stand with the president every single time. I'll fight to be a bipartisan voice with him and I will stand up to him. Now, juxtapose that with if my opponent got in.
Well, let me jump in because I've got one more question and you touched on something that relates to it when you were mentioning the Medicare for all. So let me squeeze this one in. This one, and now is your turn, your message. You have ads that are accusing Dana Balter of dishonesty regarding her position on raising taxes on working families. And you've got a clip of her. And also you've got another clip, I think, of Bernie Sanders saying regarding the Medicare for all plan that, you know, it would require raising taxes. I think the argument from the Medicare for all people is that such a tax hike would be offset by lower health care costs overall for working families. So I wanted to put this question to you, and we've only got about 45 seconds left here. Do you really think that she's being intentionally dishonest about the raising taxes issue?
Absolutely.
Or is it more of a matter of how you see the numbers?
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. Joe Biden has said Medicare for all will destroy Medicare for seniors. He also said it would force a middle class tax hike. And he also said that's Washington dictating your health care. And he also said, and Biden said, I mean, and Sanders said, it's a $30 trillion price tag over 10 years at least. At least. So it is absolutely going to cost people more to have a government-run healthcare system. It's far, and Medicare for all for seniors would be in great jeopardy. So there's no question about it. So when Dana Balter stares right into the camera and says, I am not going to raise taxes on middle class, Joe Biden is saying, yes, you are. And he's a standard bearer of your party. And if that's not to me being dishonest and deceitful, I don't know what is.
Okay, well,
Well,
unfortunately, I've got to leave it there. That was Congressman John Katko from New York's 24th Congressional District. Congressman Katko, I want to thank you again for talking to me once again and to also wish you good health to you and your family for the rest of the session.
Well, I wish the same to you, my friend, and I always enjoy these conversations. They're very good, and we cover a lot of ground, and I'm always amazed, as I said at the beginning, how quickly it goes. So
it
I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.